problems exist, however, not only between different languages, but also in the same language. I would like to tell you a little story that illustrates such an understanding problem. In Munich, there is a zoology professor who is unusually strict, requires that his students not only know the anatomy and physiology of animals thoroughly, but he also wants them to know the animals, and especially the birds, as creatures, and be able to identify them. As part of the recent examination, he placed 10 birds on a table and covered them with clothes, leaving only their feet exposed. The students were supposed to identify them only by their feet. Most of the students could scarcely manage 2. And the professor was enraged. When one of the students could not identify a single bird, the professor could not contain himself. How is it possible for such an ignorance to even be admitted to an examination? The student replied, "Just the feet are not enough for an identification." The professor exploded, "Get out of here! I don't want to see you again!" The student went to the door, and the professor called after him, "Wait a minute, what is your name? I have to cross your name off my list." The student walked back, lifted his trousers, up above his feet and said, "Why don't you guess, professor?" He does not want to be progressive. The alternative to being progressive would mean being regressive. And who would be willing to be burdened with said accusation? If you tell someone, "Sir, you are wrong, you have illusions, you have wrecks in your head," this is no polite expression. But if someone is addressed to this way, he will probably not lose his composure, but react appropriately. But if a downy beard tells his elder, "Sir, you are light years behind the times," we say in German, behind the moon, "you have not yet comprehended the spirit of our time, you are the victim of your arterial sclerosis," in this case, the one who is addressed will easily feel compromised and rejected. What could he answer to that charge? After all, the man is right, at least about the arterial sclerosis, and an objective argument was not at all called for. In other words, the vile accusations were not concerned with truth or falsehood, but rather with the issue of conservative and progressive. It is quite probable that on the basis of this type of argument, or rather non-argument, one retreats from the mental difficulties of a genuine dispute to the same degree as one abandons oneself to slogans and lets them run wild. For the labels reactionary or progressive can of course be attached or scribbled anywhere without the least intellectual strain. For that reason, it is worthwhile to go to the root of that spiritual situation which has declared itself as the Magna Carta of progressism. The concepts conservative and avant-gardist have gained the status of alternatives. And in this context, the conservative appears as an evil and its alternative as good. That is good which is natural, which serves progress and avant-gardism. In my opinion, it is valuable for the precision of our concepts to subject our language to a little treatment by eliminating this somewhat infantile alternative of conservative and progressive. For I hold the daring opinion that this verbal savagery originates from the dictionary of inhuman barbarism. One should not doubt that this barbarism is at work also among us. Of course, the word conservative has nothing, indeed absolutely nothing, to do with reactionary backwardness and hostility toward the future. Rather, the word conservative originated as a polemic and programmatic word opposed to the French Revolution and its abstract ideological construction of history. It originates here. Alone for that reason, it could not be an expression for ossification, because the word conservative conceived the right of real history in opposition to the state which is constructed artificially and abstractly and which is proclaimed to be right. To be sure, the conservative wants to preserve that which has developed historically, or he hopes to retrieve it out of historic oblivion. But he does so not in order to do homage to the principle of inertia or to conserve the status quo, but rather only because that which has developed could have proven itself. But this one cannot determine without employing the criteria of reason and conscience. The conservative must therefore be a mature and engaged spirit. For this reason, it is a mark of the conservative person that he orients himself by the real and lived life of concrete history, and that he therefore remains rather immune over against preconceived ideological or utopistically constructed views of man. On the other hand, whoever assumes that traditional structures are only miserable and worthy to be damned, and that only the future conceived in a dream is good, he can only be pitied because of the disillusionment which he will certainly experience. After all, no one less than Mephistopheles has said, "All that is worthy of destruction." With this, we have already given a prelude to that which must be said about the word avant-gardistic. This word avant-gardistic would indeed be of breathtaking matter of banality if it meant only that we should improve the chance of peace and justice, that we should fight against hunger, curb the increasing world population, and lessen the difference between rich and poor by means of adequate socio-economic reforms. If only this would be implied by the word avant-gardistic, it would be a matter of course from which no one would want to exclude himself. Unfortunately, the avant-gardist is not satisfied with this comparative making better. Rather, the avant-gardist drives an utopian and distant goals which concretize what the world is yet to be. He thrives on the envisioned goal of a world in which all domination is gone, a world which not only promises the perfection of the world order, but rather also the perfection of man himself, who has then put off all alienating structures and who can thus emerge in his true selfhood and original goodness. It is a secularized dream of the heavenly Jerusalem. Secularized because it is no longer God who brings forth the new world, but rather man himself, the Homo Faber. Of one measures the world as it exists today by the criterion of this vision of the future, the contemporary world, of course, flunks the exam with flying colors. In that case, only the Mephistophelic diagnosis is adequate that the world is worthy to be destroyed. The Mephistopheles of the 20th century only adds the thesis of the so-called dialectic of the negative, which states in a vulgar interpretation, once one has reduced everything to ruins, some phoenix will appear which elevates itself out the ashes, out of the ashes. So rabid are here the customs, and equally transitory. For the avant-gardistic conceptions supplant each other rapidly. They become obsolete faster than electronically guided anti-missile systems. Even while the word avant-gardist today is still blossoms fully and is still considered to be chic, already some frost has fallen on the concept progress in the spring night of the faith in the future. A fly is found increasingly in the soup of progress by ecologists, traffic experts, city planners, and cultural philosophers. Sociologists, who least of all suffer under the tendency to self-criticism, still slumber unperturbed toward the bright morning of their project. But also for them, the hour of truth will come. Before I talk about this crisis in the belief of, in the future, I must still briefly indicate how it has evolved. In this, I will withstand the professor's temptation to get submerged in the ocean of history, so as to describe the history of the ideal of progress beginning with the 13th century. For that could be altogether possible. In fact, at another place in my, in the first volume of my book, The Evangelical Faith, I have had something printed regarding this point. Rather, I will only pose a question. What in our time has stimulated the trust in progress? To this question, I dare to provide a very simple answer. I am so bold as to suggest that the inherent impetus of technical development itself has driven us to this belief. I may be permitted briefly to explain this. Technology has in our life some kind of omnipresence. Even if I attempt to enumerate all the technical phenomena in this hall, And if I wanted to enumerate all those technical means which have made it possible for us to be here, I would need rather much time. For technology surrounds us from the moment we rise in the morning to the time we go to bed. This is probably also the reason that technology does not only determine our external life, but rather also exerts an inner influence. Perhaps we may say it creates a world view, for it suggests to us a forward development which is irreversible, an optimism which creates in us a progressive mood. What I mean here, I would like to illustrate with a small anecdote, and I believe that it is a precise model. As young future professors, we had during the Third Reich all to attend an academy for professors, which at the time was located at Kiel. We were about 60 people from all faculties. Whenever 60 young people, technicians, medical doctors, agronomers, physicists, theologians, and philosophers are together, there are of course hot debates, and of course final issues are raised in their context. So it happened that we all discussed the meaning of life and the meaning of history. The presence of theologians, of course, did not prevent this discussion to the contrary. It came about that an admiral invited us during one of the last days to board a battleship in the harbor of Kiel. While we were walking down to the harbor in silence, the 3 weeks' discussions that lay behind us were still going in our minds. Discussions which had raised in us a feeling we have really marched in circles for millenniums. We have considered not one question which the pre-Socratics had not considered before us. And out of this feeling, one of us said, "Isn't it terrible that we have walked in circles thousands of years, the same questions have been raised, and no answers have been found?" When we had looked at the battleship and duly admired this miracle of technical rationality and efficiency that made for the whole of the mutually interdependent weapons systems on the ship, the theme Kalec said again, "I wonder what is a greater achievement? Kant's critique of the pure reason or this battleship?" That was a blow below the belt, for it appeared altogether incommensurable to relate these two entities to one another. But the issue was, after all, rest, and it appeared to me that there was something profound in this observation. For why are these so different spiritual achievements, Kant's critic of pure reason and this battleship? Well, apparently because a philosopher, just like the pre-Socratics, raises final questions and basically never arrives at a concluding answer, so that every generation must raise it again. A technical entity, like the battleship, on the other hand, is a product of obviously progressing developments and answers which become increasingly better. For it is with philosophical questions just like with religious ones. They are never ultimately answered. Even the experiences of life, one cannot pass on to the next generation. Each one must begin anew in this realm. If one is father, he knows what that means. One would like so much to make shortcuts, but it does not work. The young fellows, but also the young ladies, have to learn from their own experience. Every generation would like to begin at point zero again. But with a battleship, the symbol of technology, this is obviously different. In technology, there are no struggles between the generations, but rather the new generation stands on the shoulders of the older one. Here we find a clear continuity of an irreversible progress. But in philosophy, as well as in poetry, as in all the human sciences, there happen also regresses and setbacks. Here it happens frequently that after a time of classics and kings, there comes a time of paupers and dwarfs. But in technology, there never happens any regress, excepting a few breakdowns. We can be absolutely certain that the roadability of our automobiles will become better and better, that the ratio of weight and power will always improve. We can be absolutely certain, I dare to say it, without being a prophet, that we will not see again the boxy gas buggies at former years with their frequent breakdowns because we have become regressive. That is not possible. We have to pause and think that here are at work different dimensions of life and also of spirit, dimensions with completely contradictory structures. If we live now in a technological time in which technology exerts as an omnipresent phenomenon these impulses and suggestions, then one understands that it becomes contagious as a worldview, so that, in other words, it transplants its law of progress also onto that being which uses technology. Technology, therefore, suggests that the laws of progress applicable in its limited sphere have general validity even for man himself. Over against this, Goethe says, mankind strides forward eternally, and implies with this man's achievement, but man himself always remains the same. Now, the concept of progress, as it is intimated by the technological age, stimulates increasingly uneasy feelings in us. This hoarfrost on the bliss of progress comes about because we come back to man as the insuperable hindrance. To man who withdraws from the mechanism of progress. One can see by the changes of the utopias how little man himself fits into the scheme of progress. At the latest, with Berdyaev and George Orwell, man begins to fear that which is handed over to him in the form of that which is technologically realizable. The world of a total technical, physical, and biological manipulation, a world in which all is possible, raises fearful specters and appears to be inhuman. Man thus begins to be frightened of himself. For this reason, the fear of man himself grows so that degree to which he is capable by technology of developing and blowing up out of proportion all positive but also frightening possibilities which slumber within his heart. The man equipped only with bow and arrow is much less capable of permitting the abysmal and destructive to become effective than the man to whom the knowledge of atomic physics is given. In this way, utopian dreams have suddenly become shocking utopias. Even the magazines have become quite aware of this, for they have learned that the intimidating the readers raises the circulation, and that there is the public masochistic delight in the destruction. But also in another way, utopias, these preferred idols of the faith in progress, have changed. Originally, utopias were ideal projections of historical goal. For example, in Marxism, the classless society of the world without hunger and injustice. To this ideal projection was then attached the question of how these goals were to be realized, either by the class war or rather by consequent pacifism. Now, on the other hand, utopias experience a change in form. For today, one no longer asks for the utopian goals and only secondarily for the means to realize these, but rather the situation has reversed. For at first, the technical means are present in the physical and biological spheres. One is in command of these means. And precisely the fact that one is in command is the difficulty. For the question arises, is man capable of coping with that which is at his disposal? Let us look at only three examples. First, the power of atom is at our disposal, but from this we do not derive the utopian goal of a world changed by solar energy, as it may have been in former days, but rather one asks how we can cope with these means given into our hands. In this way we arrive at the concept of the balance of terror, or also at the vision of a world state with the help of which one can in some way cope with these means given to us. Secondly, the biological means, the means of the preservation of life and the prolongation of life, are given to us in modern medicine. Immediately we are confronted with a population explosion. We do not arrive at the dream of eternal life, which would be open to us by utopian visions. Rather, we are beset with the terrors of a population explosion and have to ask, how are we to cope with this problem? Third, there are medical means of contraception, the pill. Also here, one does not dare to entertain the dream of a sexually fulfilled world, but rather we see emerging the horrors of an endangering of sex, depersonalization of sex, physiologization, in essence, zoologization. And now we have to ask, how shall we cope with this brutalization and corruption of sex? How can we maintain its human qualities? Utopias are therefore today corrupted by the fact that ideal projections are no longer drafted at all, the realization of which would consequently be demanded of us. Rather, the tasks of coping with our capacities formally devour us, tasks which former generations have conceived as utopian dreams. With this, we have come upon a phenomenon which has in the meantime become famous, so that I do not have the chance to tell you anything new. I mean the ambivalent character of progress. I may be permitted to help our imagination along a little with few more illustrations. First, the automobile, this favored child of our civilization, staked a symbol and sign of identification of world communication. This great means of communication also causes the pollution of the atmosphere and clogs up the highways which are built for that mean. First, the automobile, this favored child of our civilization, staked a symbol and sign of identification of world communication. This great means of communication also causes the pollution of the atmosphere and clogs up the highways which are built for that means. Stated differently, the technical means rise up against the ends whose helper they were supposed to have been. This is an example of the mentioned ambivalence. Or, this is a second example, we love to speak with those stupid and undifferentiated slogans which have become the fashionable jargon of today. For example, we say that we live in the society of consumer goods. In this statement is contained, of course, a partial truth, as in all slogans. After all, slogans are the truth of former times, which have begun to decompose. Certainly, it is correct that our technological civilization provides us with a super abundant assortment of consumer goods, of food and drink, domicile, travel and leisure time. Even the so-called little man is taken care of with a comfort of which the medieval feudal lord would not even have dared to dream when he, in all his pain of rheumatism, gout, and toothaches, looked down out of the confines of his castle on the land below him, and perhaps consoled himself with the thought, all of this is subject to you, to me. But although the consuming society has its limitations. The maximum of consumption is reached when mankind needs more time to consume goods than it has at its disposal in the leisure moments between work and going to bed in the evening. Of course, one could add that the maximum of consumption is also reached at that point at which the burdened manager organism simply cannot stand anymore. Once upon a time, a guest in a first-class hotel certainly gained some prestige points when he ordered an opulent meal with six courses. But if he today is content with a pitiful tomato juice, the waiter suspectfully whispers to one another that that fellow must have at least 300 employers. The meaning of this observation, of course, cannot be to decorate the house of our life with the sinister paintings of a common cultural pessimism. Rather, this observation is to contain only a twofold indication. First, it shows us the hollowness of a naive faith in progress, and it warns us not to abandon ourselves unreflectedly to avant-gardistic dreams. Secondly, this observation poses the decisive question, what the nature of this strange law of ambivalence is. But before I turn to this decisive and last question, I beg for a few minutes of patience as we engage in a short interview. In spite of the fact that the utopian dreams and goals of former days have in the public opinion today generally been compromised, so as to be more and more the cause of frustration, of uneasiness, skepsis, indeed of shock, in spite of this fact we are confronted today with a strange flight into the future, an almost irrational expectation that in the future there may nevertheless be found fulfillment which could retrieve us out of today's miseries. One only has to reminisce on the boom of the so-called futurology in order to become aware of this phenomenon. One must consider the future-oriented peace research institutions which sprout out of the ground almost like mushrooms and which live in the illusion, I state this provocatively, as if the research of situations of conflicts will really bring anything new, and as if the recognition of the origins of conflicts could bring them under control. Corresponding to the skepticism of the future, this seems to appear here in a paradoxical manner in exuberant hope in the future, which in my field finds expression in a somewhat euphoric theology of hope. Whoever today presents himself as a futurologist or a theologian of hope is considered a limine as being up to date and as a refined gentleman. I do not intend to prejudice you with my slightly ironical remarks against a legitimate futurology, even though I consider the word detestable and also basically wrong. I have nothing against a futurology which becomes effective in long-term prognosis and projects, for example in the field of projected plans for traffic and education, urban planning, and in other spheres which can be statistically analyzed. The alternative to such planned projects of the future would only be an amateurish improvisation, an unsystematic patchwork, and a treating of symptoms instead of getting to the root of the problem. This none of us can wish. For this reason, the opposite, namely the future-oriented planning or the futurological calculation, is legitimate. What I turn against is therefore not the rationally calculated expectation of the future, but rather the ideological glorification of the future or the flight into the future. I have already mentioned some forms of this flight, and I would like to remind you mainly of the prognosis of Marxistically oriented sociology, a set of Marcuse or Habermann. These prognoses say nothing more than that non-repressive social structures would also produce a new man. A man who would, without any aggressive drives, live as a content and happy elf, surrounded by a world without crime, because criminal inclinations originate only from wrong societal structures, but not out of man himself. In fact, Marcuse contends that then even the animal kingdom will take on the semblance of paradise. Then the large fish will no longer eat the small one, because he will have enough food, and I may be permitted to add somewhat maliciously, because he is then capable of switching to vegetarianism. If for the sober mind such fantasies about the future will automatically cease to have fascination, then other forms of the expectations will manifest themselves in the minds of those who suffer less from the lack of rational self-control. I'm thinking of the fascinating slogan of a unified world government in which militant conflicts will cease and in which the hostilities will be lessened, because they will be comparable to national political issues enlarged to global proportions. I consider this dream today to be avant-gardistic, to be nothing but vanishing form, not because it appears to be unrealistic about this one could conceivably have differing opinions, but rather for very different reasons. In this dream of a world government and of a global national politics, one overlooks the real nature of man. One overlooks, according to Goethe, that man will always remain the same, that man is a highly questionable figure, and, as I may be permitted to state as a theologian, because man stands in the shadow of the fall. Both the medieval Antichrist dramas and Soloviev in his story about the Antichrist had deeper insights into this problem. For here, the dream of a world community which promises universal peace is developed, but in the fashion that this dream, even though this may appear to be a contradiction, is consistently thought through. Thereby it becomes apparent, as Lord Acton has seen, that total power also corrupts totally, and that fallen mankind is incapable of enduring the possession of uncontrolled power covering the whole globe, and that in that case his Promethean or his kinetic nature becomes active. For this reason, the world emperor of those Antichrist visions does not carry the semblance of the world savior, but rather He appears to be demonic. There is just no institutional security against the devil and against the pact which man has made with him. You know what I am implying. The potential of evil present in man will find its way into all structural forms of the world organization and will become active as kinetic energy. It is a blindness over against reality, a blindness which the Bible calls foolishness, to cultivate the illusion that the evil can be slightly passed over or structurally outwitted. Far be it from me, of course, to imply herewith that one should therefore let things be as they are, that the old Adam is incurable, no matter what one attempts. Of course, one must attempt to find out the least evil and to determine at least the optimal possibility of coping with this nature of man. I believe, for example, that the democratic form of government, with its division of power, is such a possibility. What I oppose is only the misleading and unrealistic dream of a future world in which the harmony of the Garden of Eden could be approximated. For this reason, I consider as pure illusion this progressive sounding thesis of national politics on the global scale. Sometimes I have the feeling that this flight into the future is a precipitate of the lost transcendence, of the lost religion. For wherever the present, to speak with Leopold von Ranke, is no longer understood in its immediacy to God, it is miraculously emptied. This voiding can lead either to the Mephistophelian thesis that it is worthy of destruction. It can lead to surrender and to the call, after us comes the flood. Or this voiding can lead to the tendency to cling to the idea of future fulfillment so that one falls for utopias. After all, today everything is so terribly stratified. We live everywhere under constraints of some sort. Technocratic society forces us to play predetermined roles. The path to the top is barricaded to us. Heaven seems to be empty. We are shut into finality, which is at peace with itself. We are, as Sartre expressed it in his vision of hell, among ourselves. Only the future is open. Here we still find the hot liquid lava which may yet be formed. Only here nothing is fixed. Here we still find the stuff for open possibilities and for dreams. The ideologically transfigured future is the substitute of that generation which has lost eternity and the living God. With this, I now approach the end of the attempt to evaluate the many phenomena which we have investigated. You surely understand that I can hardly do this without bringing into play our vocation as theologians and pastors. We mentioned the questionableness and the ambivalence of progress, the nothingness of ideological expectations of the future. Albert Einstein once said, we live in a time of perfect means and of vague goals. Perfect means and vague goals. What does he imply with this statement? With our technical means, we landscape the paths through the world increasingly better. We increasingly make life easier. We eliminate physical labor. Our welfare states reduce social misery. Yes, indeed, we build beautiful and smooth highways of asphalt and for life. The problem is only that we don't know where they lead us. And one day we will pose the question which Camus once asked, for what purpose do we do this, and what is its meaning? Where do we find that for which to live is worthwhile? Werner Heisenberg points into the same direction. A quote by him is this: with apparently limitless extent of its material power, mankind arrives at the point of the captain whose ship is so massively built from steel that the needle of his compass will no longer point the north, but rather only to the iron masses of his ship. With such a ship, it is no longer possible to reach any goal. It will only move in circles and will be subject to winds and sea currents. Einstein had said, perfected means and vague goals. If I take seriously this word of the great physicists, the decisive point is this, that they do not see the most basic need of our times in technology itself, nor in industrialization, nor in the material realm at all, but that they rather see this need to lie in the nature of that being which brings forth this realm. Man himself is a great question mark of the modern world. Indeed, that which we have called the ambivalence of progress is only the mirrored image of the ambivalence of man himself. The ambiguity of his greatness as a creature which has a mission and a task, as well as of his misery and decadence. The so-called progress is merely the progressive self-realization of man. If he has lost God, and if he is thereby confronted with a black wall of nothingness, then this condition shows up in the technological civilization projected, so to say, in gigantic proportions and on a huge screen, namely as a condition of being lost in the mess, as a helplessness within social compulsions, as a condition of being without soul, in the state of being surrendered to anonymous structures. I could continue with a description of this projected image. What man is capable of is surely very impressive when he turns over the world and when he implants unto the world his footprints until he has become a secular system and an image of himself, and until, I may remind once more of Heisenberg, he finally stands over against only himself. Sometimes one is reminded of the world by Sophocles in view of this powerful creative force of man. Many mighty things exist, but nothing is more powerful than man. But isn't it strange? The more closely we look at the huge tapestry of human culture and civilization, the clearer the red thread stands out like a switching artery amid all the other figures. Mother Earth, on which stand cities and cathedrals, factories and power plants, has drunk the blood of Abel. This blood of the murdered and mistreated appears in traces even amidst the greatest. Cain, the brother and ancestor of the human race, it is difficult for me not to employ these biblical models, this Cain makes himself felt in a mysterious presence. In every symphony, the melody of death is somewhere noticeable. In every Doric pillar, this sign is somewhat present. It's not part of the greatness and Apollonian brightness of Greek art also slaves, the disinherited, the misery of the serfs and coolies? Was not the greatest that was ever created by man founded on an earth which has drunk the blood and sweat of these disinherited? Do we have to wait for Marxism to open up this perspective to us? Or should we not rather know this from the history of Cain and Abel? Is it indeed true what Treitschke once dared to say, a statue of Phidias more than compensates all the misery of millions of ancient slaves? Whom do we choose, Treitschke or this archaic history of Cain and Abel? But because man is the real problem of the world and the question mark in all progress, for this reason everything depends on the change that takes place in man himself if he intends to change the world. He must recognize that he is a being in need of salvation, that he could be in altogether hopeless situation without the sustaining and saving grace which supports him. It is a dangerous illusion to think he could save himself in endowing the world with new and better structures. Not that he should refrain from such improvement. It would be silly to take the easy way out into this pitiful laissez-faire disposition. I only oppose the false hopes tied to such structural improvements, against the hope that man could lose his questionableness. This solution, this redemption, awaits him in an altogether different place. For this reason, I am glad to have a theological vocation. For this theological vocation commits me and us to work on this center of humanity. In the Bible, it is called the heart. For in the proclamation of Jesus, this heart is a key to the understanding of the world. All individual and group egoisms, the sacro egoismo of states, the conflicts of interests, competitions and suppressions are in this context only the microcosmic image of that which hones our hearts, and for that reason reconciliation has this center in mind. The Christian is then obligated to say the following to the plans to change the world. There is no doubt that we have the duty to make this questionable world a little more just, a little more free, a little more satisfied. If I express myself so cautiously, and if I mention only a puny comparative, a little more efficient, rather than proud utopias, then I do this to indicate the limits of what is possible for us and call for humility. Mainly, this call is to be a warning of ideologically speculative hopes. He who has promised heaven on earth has, at least up to this point, only turned this earth into hell. But if we are confronted with this task to improve the world a little more, just a little better, then everything depends on the priorities. And the question number one remains how we shall cope with man and with the human heart, or whom we shall entrust with this task. If the young generation today is shaken with revolutionary tremors and many other forms of discomforts, if it flees out of the desert of meaninglessness into the imaginary world of drugs, this condition would be interpreted far too superficially if one would see it only excitement about authoritarianism, about Vietnam, or about the lack of concern over against the younger nations. I see the problem of today's youth to lie deeper, perhaps even deeper than it sees itself, because youth cannot even articulate its problems. The true problem lies in what is today often called the incongruency between that which man is destined to be and the realization of this task. In other words, between his ought and that which he is. This is a result of a great sin against youth. Youth calls it alienation. Because under this problem is hidden the question for the being of man and how he could find himself. For this reason, I believe nevertheless in youth. For I understand that it is seeking for a path which we of the older generation have all too often lost because an other vision and other values interest us. This path of which I am speaking is nothing else but a disguised religious issue. It is our task to help youth to translate this disguised form into the real issue. But now I thank you for your patience with which you followed me through the many implications of the background of our modern time.